whenever I'm in the area of Arnhem, I used to come to this place here and to have a look. And this affects me much more.
The laddie beside me suddenly disappeared, and when I looked round, he was lying on his back with a hole through the tip of the middle of his head.
The feeling was there, we're doomed.
It was ambitious, and it was a risk, but it was worth it.
It was the last German victory.
It's the 17th of September, 1944. John Jeffreys dropped in to Arnhem, into Ginkle Heath, and this was his experience. He said, "As I came down near Ginkle Heath, I was shot by a German that was on the ground. It was a bit disconcerting as my elation of arriving was squashed down when I realised that I couldn't move my leg as my nerves had been severed." So it's Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, the battle that was going to end World War II 9 months earlier than it actually did. It's the 80th anniversary this week, so I thought it would be appropriate to record one, maybe even two podcasts. We'll see how we get on. So many stories to tell. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And I had my first ever visit to Arnhem a few weeks ago when we were carrying out a recce for a special 80th anniversary tour. And I was supposed to be guiding for Ledger Battlefield tours that, as you probably know, I've done on a number of occasions. Unfortunately, due to family circumstances, I'm unable to go this week. But I thought I would still want to be part of those commemorations, and what better way of doing that than to listen to some of the words and consider some of the actions carried out by those brave men from the 1st Airborne Division that dropped in to that Dutch town all those years ago. So before we go any further, I thought it would be appropriate really just to recap on what the plan was, what actually happened at Arnhem. I'm not going to go into this in detail because you probably realise there's lots of excellent podcasts out there that do examine the strategic aims, objectives from a military point of view, but that's not what this podcast is all about. It's all about listening, considering the words of the men themselves that were there. But Brussels had fallen, the capital of Belgium, on the 3rd of September. The Germans were in full retreat after the D-Day and after the Normandy campaign. Paris had also fallen during August, but they still had to break into Germany. They got to get across the Rhine. And that was the whole idea of Operation Market Garden, with Garden being for the ground offensive and Market the airborne offensive. And they dropped 8 miles away from their objective, which was to be, and what we're going to concentrate just on, the Arnhem Bridge in this podcast. The German divisions had been decimated after Normandy. And to be honest, from the records that I read, the British actually underestimated them. They thought they would collapse. They'd got air superiority that gave them that feeling of confidence. And they were in high hopes that they could achieve their objective. But what they didn't know was that there were two SS panzer divisions that were refitting in Holland, having escaped from the Falaise Gap. But to get an idea of how confident the British were, we can listen to the words of Major General John Frost, the commanding officer of the 2nd Battalion of the Parachute Regiment. This was the unit that held the bridge for several days before they were virtually wiped out by the Germans. But as I say, they were in high hopes, and this is what he said.
No, I'm very optimistic. Don't forget, we'd had the German army had taken the most tremendous hiding in Normandy, and all the information was that they were a beaten force retreating more or less in disorder back to behind the Siegfried Line and back into Germany. So I was expecting to a fairly easy battle. We knew that the whole of the British army was coming up to cross over the bridges after we'd taken them. And one could see they were fresh, they'd had rested, re-equipped. One could see absolutely no reason why the thing shouldn't go according to plan.
So it's an ambitious plan. taken advantage of what they thought was a shattered German army. If they could get across the Rhine and into the Ruhr Valley and cripple the German industrial power, then the war could have ended before Christmas. We've heard that before, haven't we, from a previous conflict. So they landed on these drop zones to the west of Arnhem, but German resistance, the bad weather, problems with supplies and reinforcements all led to heavy losses, and their objectives were not taken. The northern side of the Arnhem Bridge was taken by Frost and his men. They held it for several days, but to the south, they were hoping that 30 Corps were going to arrive at the southern side of the bridge. They would be able to take it, that they would be reinforced by comrades coming in through Oosterbeek and Arnhem. That didn't happen because the Germans prevented it from happening. They were forced to form a perimeter around Oosterbeek. They held that stubbornly for a few days, and then it was decided to withdraw what was left of the division across the Lower Rhine, and that was the end of the 8 or 9 day battle, whichever way you want to measure it. So that's all I'm going to say really about the history of the battle. Let's now look at the experiences of some of those men that were there. And I think what I'm going to try and do is do it in chronological order. So let's first of all look at what happened when the gliders and paratroopers dropped into those landing zones. Now, we've heard from a commanding officer, John Frost, that the spirits of the men were high. What about the men themselves? What do they say? Well, Freddie Dixie Dean, as he was known, he agrees with Frost in an interview he gave to the British Forces television a few years ago. This is what he said.
Guys were enormously cheerful and, just dying to get on with it.
Personally, when I stood there at Ginkle Heath the other week, looking at this vast open space, looking at the memorials that were there, I tried to imagine what it must have been like to parachute into that area on the 17th and the 18th of September. And as a civilian, it's impossible. So once again, Dixie tells us what it was like to actually land at Arnhem.
As soon as you got out of the plane, there's a moment's silence, and then there was small arms fire, machine gun fire and rifles from the surrounding woods. And when we hit the deck, you were hoping you wouldn't get hit while you were a sitting duck. Some were. But I mean, when you got on the ground, the heather, which was supposed to be clear, was ablaze. The small arms fire coming from the woods. And it was great to see a rifle platoon, having dropped not far away, walk forward towards these woods. It was a big expanse of heather, you know. But towards the woods where, abreast, they were a perfect target for anybody in the woods. I mean, they walked towards echelon like that towards the woods, and they cleared it, you know.
So another impossible thought that I've had over the years that I've been a battlefield guide is wondering what it must be like to be hit and wounded. Well, that's exactly what happened to Dixie.
The rest was chaos, and I, apart from getting hit, but my getting hit, we were about overrun by Germans when I was hit. And I felt this god-awful bang on my in my face. It was like being, as I could imagine, the only thing I could liken it to was as if I'd been hit in the six hits at cricket with a bat, you know. A hit full in the face. That was the experience. And I saw stars. I was blind for quite a few minutes. So no, time doesn't fit, you know. You can't actually know the time when you're blinded and shot.
Hit by a cricket ball, he says. Well, I've been hit by a cricket ball when I was a child. It hurt for a little while, but his injuries were more permanent. In the video I'm watching, he's got a patch over that eye where he was shot. Somehow he lived. He was taken prisoner by the Germans and he returned home after the war 9 months later. So what's his feelings about what happened there? Well, let's see, shall we?
Oh, you can be proud to have been there with the guys who were there. Jeez, the bravery was extraordinary. I mean, amazing. Amazing guts. One witnessed. But I mean, it was... Everybody sensed. As soon as they hit... That landing ground should have been clear. It had been cleared once, but the reinforcements had been brought up. They knew it was coming. Forever. Glad I was with those chaps, but on the other hand, they deserved better in the planning here. They really did.
Now, one of the things that hadn't occurred to me until I started reading the various books about Arnhem was the amount of kit that they had to wear. It wasn't just about the parachutes, but they had to take all their kit with them. They were going to be resupplied from the air, but of course they had to take as much as possible to be able to fight the Germans in resistance that they didn't know at this stage how strong it was going to be. One of those books that I've read was written by a man called Geoffrey Powell, and he called it Echoes of War, The Men at Arnhem. It was first published in 1976, and this is what he wrote about the preparations for taking off and the landings themselves. He says, the long lines of pot-bellied Dakotas drawn up on the runway brought home again the immense scope of it all. At more than 20 other airfields across the country, trucks were disgorging their loads of men and vehicles by the side of waiting aircraft and gliders. The same thing had happened yesterday, and it would happen again tomorrow if all went well. I'd read the preparations for D-Day, but now I could see for myself the size of the Americans' and British war efforts. The Germans were all but beaten. I knew, as we all did, that to win this battle would prevent another winter of war. So once again, that's the third example we've got of the men that were jumping into Arnhem being absolutely sure that what they was going to do was going to succeed. Defeat had not even entered their heads. This was going to win the war. He goes on, he says, now came the familiar toil of struggling into jumping kit. Now, again, this was so important, this preparation. They'd done this over and over again during their training exercises. I think I also read that about 17 times the 1st Airborne Division had been tasked with parachuting into enemy territory, but all of the previous occasions the operations had been cancelled and had been through the same preparation. He says, over my battle dress and airborne smock, I was already wearing full equipment, the haversack containing maps, torch and other odds and ends, respirator, water bottle and compass, pistol holder and ammunition case, and on my chest the two pouches crammed with Sten magazines and hand grenades. Across my stomach, I then tied my small pack, solid with 2 days' concentrated rations, mess tins, spare socks, washing kit, pullover, a tin mug, all topped with a Hawkins anti-tank grenade. Slung around my neck were binoculars, while a large shell dressing, a Morpheus syringe and red beret was tucked into my smock pockets. Next, I wrapped myself in a denim jumping jacket to hold the bits and pieces in place and prevent the parachute cord snagging. Over everything went a Mae West life jacket, with a camouflage net scarf around my neck and a parachutist steel helmet covered with a scrim decorated net on my head. Onto my right leg I then tied a large bag, into which was packed a Sten gun together with an oblong-shaped walkie-talkie radio and a small entrenching tool. A quick-release couch allowed this bag to be lowered in mid-air so that it would dangle below on a thin cord and hit the ground before I did. Next, Private Harrison helped me into my parachute, and I did the same for him. After which, we both tested each other's quick-release boxes to make certain they were working properly. We were loaded like pack donkeys. One of the drawbacks of being taken into battle by air with so few vehicles available to carry kit. If we were to eat, drink, dig and fight with some hope of success against the heavily equipped German troops who were waiting for us, we would need everything we were carrying. As it was, we had enough food and ammunition for only a day or two. More should arrive in the supply drops. But upon this, we could not depend. And those supply drops went wrong as well, because I think I read as much as 80% of the supplies that the Allies dropped from the air didn't land into the hands of the paratroopers on the ground. No, they landed in the wrong place. From the air, it was impossible to be accurate when dropping supplies, and so much of that kit, ammunition, food, rations and everything else fell into enemy hands. One of the many things that went wrong at Arnhem. And then that moment comes when Powell's actually got to get out of the plane. A terrifying moment that must have been. And despite having done it in training, the fear of jumping from those Dakotas was too much for three of the men. They refused to jump and they were later court-martialed. But back to Powell's recollections. He says, I braced myself at the open door, the first man in the stick to jump, gripping the fuselage in case a sudden jerk flung me out too soon, leaning forward, feeling the wind whip my face, poring over the details of the placid Dutch landscape below. I could see one or two cyclists dotting the otherwise deserted countryside. The flicker of the red warning light near my face told me there was 1 minute to go. A railway line flashed below. The pattern of woods was as familiar as the view of the stable yard from the office window. The air photographs and the briefing model of the ground had imprinted the shapes in my mind. The pilots were dead on target. More often than not, in the old days, we'd dropped astray, but these Yanks all had already learned from their mistakes. I never saw the red light turn to green. Harrison's hand slapped on my shoulder and I was out of the door. The slipstream hit me, flicking me sideways, and I fell away, just catching a glimpse of Harrison in the air above me and the tail of the aircraft flashing out of sight. Then I was floating, suspended gently in mid-air, my parachute canopied high. Others who had jumped from the planes in front were already on the ground, struggling to rid themselves of their harnesses. Clouds of yellow smoke released by the pathfinders of the independent company to mark the dropping zones spread over the circles of collapsed, discarded parachutes which ringed the heathland below. I picked out the familiar landmarks, in particular the corner of the wood where C Company was to collect. I looked up at the sky choked with hundreds of swaying parachutes, most of them patterned in green and brown camouflage, but others in a galaxy of colours, red and orange, purple, blue and yellow, vivid against the scattered white clouds. Then I noticed the humming. We were being shot at from the ground. There were Bosch on a dropping zone. Something was badly wrong. An opposed landing, with the enemy firing as we hung from our parachutes or tried to collect our weapons before we could gather into a cohesive force on the ground, was something new for us in the British Airborne Forces. I was thinking of what could await us on the ground as I pulled the release catch on the kit bag tied to my leg and started to lower the burden by its long cord so it dangled free. A sharp pain burned the knuckles of my left hand. Blood was seeping from my fingers. A bullet must have hit me, grazed me anyway. But now the heathland was rushing up, rushing my hands to lift webs. I pulled and then the ground hit me with an uncomfortable jar. It was a bad landing. So already things are starting to go wrong, aren't they? He's had a bad landing, he's been shot in the hand. And the surprise and horror that those men must have encountered when they realised that the Germans were there, they must have thought that the Germans knew about it, but apparently it was a complete surprise. They didn't know that the attack was coming. But I suppose with all of those colours of the smoke in the air, they could see the men coming down. The air was full of thousands of these aircrafts, 12,000 men that were jumping into Arnhem or coming in on the gliders. This was Ginkle Heath. And this was the second day of the landings, Monday the 18th of September 1944. This was one of the subsequent drops. They didn't have enough aircraft to take the men over all in one drop. They had to be dropped in three different operations. And of course, after the first drop, there was no way that this could be a surprise to the Germans. He then says he got his kit off, as he practiced to do so many times, did that effectively. He said it was a long way across the heath to the company rendezvous point, which is at the edge of the wood. He said he was first out of the aircraft. He said the distance was about a mile to the rendezvous point. But because if you go to Ginkle Heath, it looks much bigger than that, and it looked much further. He said, now walking, now running, I felt the weight of weapons and equipment. Fit though I was, bullets still cracked overhead, and mortar bombs were exploding on the Arnhem side of the dropping zone. In places, the heather was burning. I passed men unpacking weapons, containers, the coloured parachutes still attached. Others were moving in small parties towards their collecting points. No one seemed to be getting hurt despite all the bullets flying around. Then I saw a young Hampshire lad beside a collapsed parachute. The boy's right trouser leg had been cut away and the lance corporal was tying a shell dressing around his thigh. There could be no question of stopping. I could only commiserate as I passed by. The boy's response was cheerful, but he could not disguise the edge of pain in his voice. The NCO shouted after me that he'd given the officer a shot of morphia and would find some stretcher bearers. He then talks about the Dutch civilians, because the Dutch, if you remember, had been under Nazi control for 4 long years at this stage, since May 1940, and they must have thought the liberation had arrived. They didn't understand the overall plan of Market Garden. And he says the Dutch civilians started to appear. First came an elderly doctor with 3 female companions who offered to help with the wounded. I directed them towards the dressing station where they would be welcome. Then a respectable-looking elderly man with a little girl started calmly to roll and stack parachutes, a treasure in nylon and cotton. I felt I should do something to stop the old gentleman from obviously diverting valuable government stores towards the Dutch black market, but I decided against it and it would be a waste of time. He says more and more Dutch were arriving, some of them on foot, but most of them riding bicycles. They looked prosperous and well-dressed, probably owners of comfortable suburban houses nearby. Many were sporting an orange favour, a tie, an armband or a ribbon, happy in the certainty that the army of liberation had arrived, the Boche were beaten, and for them the war was over. But Powell knew that they were still in trouble. He says even after 4 years of German occupation, they seemed to be very innocent. What trouble would they be in if the battle went the wrong way? Which of course it did, and the people of Arnhem were to pay the price for that in the months that remained. But that's another story for another day. Now we're going to follow what happened to John Frost and his 2nd Battalion, and he also talks about civilians coming across them just after they landed. This is what he said.
Well, we started meeting them straight away. People on bicycles and people welcoming, etc. Oh, they just said, "How lovely to see you. How nice, we've been waiting for so long." And they, of course, the one thing that did worry them was, where are we many? Where are we going to have enough chaps to deal with the enemy who they knew, of course, was there? The route given to me to get to the bridges was obviously along the north bank of the river and as close as possible to it. And along that route were considerable little villages and settlements, etc. And the Dutch all came to their gates to give us what they could, mostly milk, apples, etc. Oh, it was very nice, but it became a little bit of an embarrassment in a way. I think one felt the whole thing seemed a little bit incongruous, I think that's the word. No, they did all they could to help, and in fact they kept on offering us the use of their motor cars and so on.
So now, of course, they've got to make their way, the 2nd Battalion's got to make their way through Oosterbeek, through the western outskirts of Arnhem, to the northern side of the bridge. They're still hopeful, of course, that they were going to reach and achieve their objectives. And in amongst their number were 2 twin brothers, Claude and Thomas Gronaert. And they'd been born in 1923 and they came from a small village near Redruth in Cornwall. They volunteered for the airborne forces and they'd seen action during the Italian campaign in 1943. On that first day, the 17th of September, their jump was successful. They were advancing through the town and heading towards the famous road bridge. But before they could get to the road bridge, they encountered enemy forces near the railway viaduct between Oosterbeek and the Rhine River. Thomas was hit in the fight that took place. Instinctively, Claude ran over to him to his aid, but he was shot as well and mortally wounded. They were aged 21 years old and initially buried, according to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission burial report, where they fell at that railway cutting along with several others. There was a Lieutenant Levian, and he said Peter Kane's platoon led off up the track from the road by the railway bridge immediately came under pretty heavy machine gun fire. The position was observed owing to it being in dead ground. There were obvious sounds of battle. Peter screamed for a smoke verbally. It was some minutes before I could get the platoon and myself to a bank where I could see. We later found the enemy's machine guns also withdrew further back to a wood. Peter, both Gronaert twins, Corporal Rogers and Private Edwards were all killed. In October 1945, their remains were found and reburied. in the main cemetery in Oosterbeek, the main Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, which is only about a mile away from where they were killed. They did everything together in life, they died together, and they'll be buried next to each other forever and ever. They left behind mum, dad, brothers and sisters back home in that small Cornish village. But the family wrote a poem about them. It says, "In loving memory of our twin sons, Thomas and Claude Groner, both killed in the airborne landing at Arnhem, September 1945. And this is how the poem reads. "Sleep on, dear sons, in a soldier's grave, where no tears of your parents may fall on your graves. Just our sons, so upright and true, we cannot understand why it had to be both our lads. Always remembered by their loving mam, dad, brothers and sisters." But a few years later, their mum did visit their graves at Oosterbeek, and I found an image in one of the newspapers of the time of Mrs. Grunart looking at a photograph of her two sons while she sits at their grave. I wonder what was going through her mind. Well, we know, because I found another newspaper article that tells us what she found when she arrived at Oosterbeek. It says that when Mrs. Groner, the mother who lost her twin sons at Arnhem, turned away from their graves in Holland last week, she found a little Dutch girl crying by the cemetery gates. Her mother's instinct prompted her to find the reason for those tears, and she heard that the child, the guardian of her son's grave, had been trying to place her amongst the crowd of 100 relatives of the airborne heroes. So what are the chances of that? She saw this little girl crying. She didn't know why she was crying, but the reason that little girl was crying was because she couldn't find the mother of those two boys whose grave she'd been looking after. And there she was, now talking to the mother of those twins. The article goes on. "Each of those graves at Arnhem," Mrs. Groner said, "was tended with loving care by a Dutch family, and they visited every week, trimmed to the neatest perfection and covered with a profusion of flowers only the Dutch could offer in such quantity." She told the newspaper that she found this sincere, lasting appreciation of the Dutch some compensation for her loss. Each grave had its cross, with the soldier's name on the front and the name of the family in whose care it was placed at the back. "It was a great ordeal," she said. "At one time I wondered how I should see it through. But now I have brought back with me a feeling of comfort I shall never lose. I know my boys will never be forgotten in Holland any more than they will be at home." Their story is extremely well known, and most visitors to the cemetery always go and pay their respects at these twins' grave. And when I return to Arnhem one day, that's what I'll be doing. And when I do so, I'll be reading that poem and that article to the people I take with me. So the 2nd Battalion moves on with John Frost leading the way, and they do indeed arrive at the bridge, and Frost himself continues the story for us.
Then we all arrived at the north end of the main bridge. That was really just one company, A Company, my own headquarters, and headquarters company, and the support company. But of course, B Company had been detached to take with high ground at Den Brink. And C Company had been slightly involved in the railroad bridge. So it was some time before they could disentangle. But we were going as hard as we could. And they had to leave them there, one at Den Brink, the other by the bridge, while we went on as hard as we could for the main bridge. Once we got to the main, it was getting dark by now. And so we, as quickly as possible, occupied those buildings which dominated the north end and the approaches to the north end. Well, there was one big old government building and a sort of factory building, etc., just on that approach to the north end. And we had been told that the Dutch underground had been very much penetrated, and it would be very unwise to rely too much on any offers of help that they gave us in the town. During by this time, although we'd managed to occupy the buildings fairly quietly, our main aim was to get across the bridge. to the far side. So one of the A Company platoons started to move across. Of course, it's a horribly dangerous thing to do, is even in the half light, because you only require one machine gun on the far end of a thing like that to cause very heavy casualties. Indeed, this is what happened, because before they'd gone very far, machine guns from either the far end of the bridge or halfway down the bridge, we don't know, couldn't see. All I know is that the bullets were scattering off the road and onto the girders beside the bridge, and that leading platoon had quite a few casualties and had to come back. And it was obvious to me that it was going to be very unlikely if we were going to be able to get across the bridge with the resources that I had available to me without having unacceptable casualties. Now, enemy opposition, I might call it rather sporadic, that began to be very much more in evidence. Well, then what I wanted to do was to see if I couldn't get one of the other companies who still hadn't emerged yet in this area to get across the river. So I sent my chief engineer, chap commanding the Sapper Squadron, down to where the pontoon bridge was. You see, I should have told you that just before we took off, or I can't remember exactly where it was, we were told that the pontoon bridge had been dismantled, and that was no longer going to be a means of getting across the river. But I obviously thought that there would be some sort of pontoons and things which might have been abuse to get across the river from that area, if possible. So I sent my sapper down to see if this was the case, and he came back and said, no, these pontoons are very great, big, heavy things which have to be towed into position by tugs, and it's quite hopeless of our trying to use them. Well, that made me all the more certain that there was no possibility of our getting across the far side of the river. Anyway, we had few enough people as it was to hold the north end, let alone bothering with the south. And so I then determined to make as tight a perimeter as we could to hold that north end, because as long as we held the north end, then if the British troops came up from the south, which is what they were meant to do, then we could deal with any anti-tank guns, etc., that could have thwarted their moves across the bridge subsequently. So I think we made one more attempt to see if we could feel our way across the bridge, but there was no doubt, as soon as any attempt was made, illuminating flares were put up by the enemy, and very heavy machine gun was brought down the thing. There was just no way of getting across. At about this time, too, three German lorries came over the river from the south, and these we set on fire, and they were full of ammunition. They burnt and made a furious noise for the rest of the night.
It's quite chilling, isn't it, when you listen to that first-hand account and you realise that although they were Nazis, although they were the SS and the enemy, that inside those trucks being burnt to death and other ways of being killed were human beings. Just so glad I wasn't there, that's all I know. So we're going to pause the podcast now for 1 minute only to say a few words about our sponsor of the podcast, Tales from the Battlefields, and that's a company called Ativo. Ativo, enriching lives through lifestyle financial planning. Lifestyle financial planning is about more than just focused financial advice. It's a tailored, holistic approach centered on your unique aspirations, individual circumstances, and evolving needs. By building a lifelong relationship based on trust and getting to know you, Ativo works with you to craft a bespoke financial plan that helps you live the style of life that you want. Their experienced, highly qualified financial specialists and expert support teams are committed to delivering more for all of their clients. It's clear, independent advice that sets them apart, helping their clients to unlock their unrealised financial potential, giving them the confidence to lead financially secure and enriched lives. To find out more, contact them through their website, www.ativo.co.uk. So back to the bridge at Arnhem now. And we've already established that the airborne division had been told that the resistance from the Germans would be minimal, but that's not what happened. So what did John Frost think when they encountered them? Was it a surprise to him?
Well, very so. I mean, we'd given absolutely no information at all about the presence of SS Panzer troops of any kind. And it was just when we were not... it wasn't very easy to pick up the German wounded because the whole area was swept by fires. But gradually, the German wounded were taken, picked up, and all staggered into our own buildings and were then put into prisoner of war camps or put down with our own wounded. And, of course, it was at this stage that we realised that these were the troops from the SS Panzer Division.
Frost then goes on to talk about his communication with General Urquhart, and that's a story we're going to take up next. What did he say about the conversation they had?
On the, I think it was the, on the Tuesday afternoon, I was able to speak to the General, Urquhart, who had been incommunicando, or municado, for some time, because he himself, as you know, this is probably the story, he had... come up to see what was happening to the 1st Brigade and had himself got bottled up in a house and was unable to take any part of the battle, in the battle, for those first day and a half. When I spoke to him, he wasn't able to hold out very much hope of relief. I just said and prayed would be ammunition is a great problem, and I think that it's vital that I couldn't say too much because, you know, the Germans would have been listening in, and if we started sort of winding and winding another, they would have sent hooray.
He's an incredible character, isn't he, John Frost? Because now what does he do? He's heard from his commanding officer that there's little hope of them being relieved. They'd only got 48 hours iron rations. The Germans had cut off the water and the electricity and other supplies to the properties. They were hitting the properties, the houses, the warehouses, schools, the church buildings that they were in. They were hitting them with incendiary devices and setting fire to the buildings. Some of the wounded were in the basements of those burning buildings and had to be evacuated. They were running out of ammunition. The Germans were no doubt strengthening their resources. There was Tiger tanks on the way from other parts of Holland to join in the fight. Frost would have known all this, and yet he's been told there's no help for you. What was he going to do? Would he surrender? That goes against the grain. Would he allow his men to be killed, and he himself to be killed? And how was he to be killed? Was he going to burn to death in that fire? Was he going to be shot? Was he going to be blown up? All these things must have gone through his mind. What about his family at home he'd have been thinking about then? It's an awful predicament that none of us listening to this 80 years on can imagine being in. I certainly can't anyway. But this isn't the sort of man that's going to give up, not without a fight anyway. But what we're going to do now, he mentioned there Urquhart's situation. Urquhart, if you remember, had left his headquarters and had gone on forward to see what was going on, see for himself, which most historians have declared this to be a mistake. I'm not here to judge. That's for academics and very clever people to do, and I'm certainly not one of those. But let's find out exactly what did happen to Roy Urquhart. After the war, Urquhart wrote his memoirs in a book he simply called Arnhem. And he describes in his own words exactly what happened when he ended up holed up in the loft of that house near St. Elizabeth Hospital. This is one of those scenes famously played out in that film, A Bridge Too Far. And he takes up the story himself. He says, convinced that we would be taken on, we were ready for a fight when we slipped out of the back door into yet another maze of tiny fenced gardens. We crossed these, turned right, then left into another terrace house set at right angles to the one we'd left. Our entry through the kitchen of number 14 came as a shock to Anton Dirksen and his family. A plump and solemn Dutchman, he pointed to the stairs just behind the door. In Dutch, he tried to tell us that the Germans were already coming round the corner. I found the stairs almost too narrow for my boots and the ceiling low for a six-footer. On the landing, we paused before entering a bedroom with a single wooded bed under the window. I glanced down into the street and saw the familiar field grey uniforms of the Wehrmacht. Opposite was the hospital. Clemenson, he was one of the three men that was with him, he took a look and said, "We can't get out this way, the place is crawling with them." Taylor, who was the third officer that was with them, he made a cautionary inspection at the back. "Can we be sure of these people?" he asked, nodding in the direction of the stairs. "There's an open attic over this room from which we might keep the entrance in view." So what he's saying is that they couldn't trust the Dutch civilians. Most of them were on the side of the Allies, but some of them were Nazis. Some of them were giving information to the Germans. They had no way of knowing on which side the Dirksen family would be on, but we now know they were a friendly family. It was not much more than a deep shelf shape by the slope of the roof and the bedroom ceiling. As we discussed the next move, a self-propelled gun whined to a stop almost right underneath our window. We climbed the detachable steps to the shelf, pulled them up after us and waited. We had pistols and we now primed our hand grenades. I had two in my blouse, which I'd forgotten about. "Funny no one followed us up," Clemenson observed. "We watched the stairs. There was no sign of any of the family we'd seen on our arrival. We hoped they and their neighbours could be relied upon not to give us away. And if we'd known more about these people, we would have been less troubled in mind. In those moments, we expected the Germans to burst in at any time. The house remained still and silent, and we could not even hear the family downstairs. I brought out a bag of sweets and a bar of chocolate that Hancock had given me in exchange for my cigarettes. Outside, we could hear German voices, and occasionally from farther away, bursts of fire. We settled back and hoped that the commotion would die down. I was then suddenly struck by the size of Clemenson's moustache, one to make the RAF envious. On such a slightly built man, they looked weird." The funny thing was that he'd only met Clemenson a few minutes earlier. He'd never met him before, and there he was with nothing else to do but look at this moustache of this young officer opposite him. He says, "Presently, when it became obvious that the Germans did not know our whereabouts, the idiocy of the situation forced itself upon me. I think it's time we tried to get out," I said. "I don't know about how you chaps feel, but we're less than useless cooped up here. I felt that as a divisional commander, I ought not to be indulging in such frolics of evasion." "I don't think it's going to be that easy yet," said Clemenson. "We can take a look." He then had a discussion with his two junior officers as to what to do. Their options were rather limited. Clemenson said, "We'd be killed or caught. I'd prefer to wait for an attack to catch up with us rather than go prowling around. Urquhart says that he was outvoted by the other two. He said there was neither food nor water in the house. The Germans had cut off supplies of water at the mains. And then, of course, they had to go to the toilet. He said, "We hated having to soil this family's living quarters. And long afterwards, when I sought out the family, I apologised for our unavoidable behaviour." So what happened in the end? How did they get out? They didn't go out in a blaze of glory, no, far from it. He says, "On the upper floor of that building, Taylor, Clemenson and I waited for signs of the British attack that we were expecting. There was nothing to suggest that the second lift might have been seriously delayed by the weather, and I wondered if that made a good start. From time to time during the night, we got up to stretch ourselves and also to glance into the street where the self-propelled gun was still stationed. We took it in turns to keep watch, and although I kept reminding myself that a commander in battle must never neglect his sleep, my mind was too active for sleep." How far had 30 Corps advanced? Had the Americans succeeded at Grave and Nijmegen? Perhaps by now the 2nd Battalion had been given some help. I wondered if Heaps and his roving companions with the Bren carriers had managed to get through with supplies to the bridge. It was very restricting in that little house, and my frustration was increasing. I must have slept for a short time. Then I awoke with a dull pain across my chest. I felt for the sore spot. My fingers touched one of the two hand grenades inside my smock. I'd been lying on them, and the pressure had bruised me slightly. At that moment, we heard the wheeze of the engine of the self-propelled gun outside, followed by shouts and the rattle of its tracks. It was moving off. And now the middle-aged Dutchman appeared and announced excitedly that the British were at the bottom of the road. We were in such a hurry to join them that we left a Sten gun on the shelf, and the family kept it for some time as a souvenir. We ran down the street, and I thanked God that we'd made contact again. An officer of the South Staffords told me something of the situation and said that his party had been sent by Hicks to help drive into the town. He's told me that your HQ is now at the Hartenstein Hotel in Oosterbeek. Although heartened by the evidence that the second lift was with us, albeit after a delay, I could see that some confusion existed. It was imperative that I should get back to my HQ as soon as possible and take a grip on the battle. I borrowed a jeep and started to drive very fast to my HQ at Oosterbeek. Taylor came with me, but Clemenson preferred to rejoin his 3rd Battalion. They must be around here somewhere, he said hopefully. I'll catch up with them. Once again, I took the lower road, which included that steep stretch exposed to the snipers across the river. I advised Taylor to duck and hold tight. I put my foot down hard. Sure enough, the bullets pinged around us. That not for the first time, and certainly not for the last, I felt like an Aunt Sally on a shooting range. We were untouched, however, and the jeep held the corner at the bottom quite well. So while all this is going on near the hospital, a couple of miles away at the bridge, the situation is getting more and more serious for Frost and his ever-dwindling number of men. He takes up the story once again for us.
All the buildings, one by one, caught fire and burnt. And this, again, was a great problem because they were largely built of wood and went on smouldering for a considerable time. So there was no refuge in the rubble, as there can be in buildings which are largely made of stone. Sometimes they're more effective to be in than the actual building itself. But once our buildings caught fire, there's no means of extinguishing the flames. They became no man's land. I don't think we lacked... We had the 48-hour rations with us, which should have been sufficient for 48 hours. And one probably eked that out quite well. The only thing we could find to eat in the Dutch houses were fruit. And a certain amount of... apples, that sort of thing, which we made use of. But that was all.
But then disaster strikes. The worst thing that can happen to any unit is that their commanding officer becomes a casualty.
I was blown up by a mortar bomb. I was having a discussion with Douglas Shorey, who's Douglas Crawley, my senior company commanders. We were actually discussing then whether there was any thing else we could do, and a mortar bomb or shell, I don't know which it was, landed right in the middle of our little group and blew us all over backwards, and we were all wounded. And of course, carried over my Batman, actually, he managed to survive that particular thing, but he was with me.
Sorry.
Yes, well, I sit on the right shin bone and the left ankle. Oh, well, there we were. Put into beds, etc. And one knew then, of course, that as soon as possible the Germans would evacuate us further. I had taken off my badge as a rack and hoped that I would somehow be able to escape as a private soldier. But I was early the next morning we were put into ambulances and driven right into Germany.
The famous author Martin Middlebrook, well known for his account of the first day of the Somme, his final book that he wrote was called Arnhem, 1944, The Airborne Battle. And there are numerous incredible accounts, and I've picked out a few for this podcast. And one of them was written in a diary by a language teacher in Arnhem, Wilhelma Schulten, I think is how you pronounce her name. This is what she wrote in her diary about the scene that she found as she passed a building, which she said someone opened the front door, and within a moment the ground floor and the basement were full of soldiers. They were tired. The floors and stairs were full of them, but they made very little noise. The fruit which I had brought that afternoon vanished in no time, and my pupils were pleased to be able to converse with them in English. Tea was made and passed around. They had bought everything, and hoping and fighting had come all the way from Renkham and Dorworth. Their next task was to occupy the bridge after a few moments of rest. Quietly and without fuss, they told their stories. There were several wounded among them. One Irishman had lost two fingers on the way. He did not want to stay behind because, he said, he could still fire with one hand. Another man had been shot in the eye and the thigh. Yet another had been shot in the stomach. He was the worst of all. Arnhem is full of incredible stories told from amazing men, and another one of those is Major Tony Hibbert. He was commissioned in the Royal Artillery in 1938, and in 1940 he found himself at Dunkirk during the evacuation, and he defended the northern perimeter for the last 4 days of the siege. And his ammunition ran out on the 31st of May. He destroyed the guns, and he was later mentioned in dispatches for his actions. And he was one of the last to be evacuated from those beaches. And then 4 years later, he finds himself commanding one of the brigades in the attack at Arnhem. And eventually, after lots of delays, he finds himself reaching the bridge to support the 2nd Battalion and John Frost.
It was a fascinating few days because, of course, I was up in the attic of this building, so I could see right over the bridge and all the way up the road on the to the north. So I had a bird's eye view of what was happening. I watched the attack on the Monday morning develop when Gravener tacked over the bridge with, I think he had about 3 or 4 armoured cars with a lot of armoured personnel vehicles. They just motored blithely over the bridge as if we weren't there, which surprised us because we thought at least, you know, they'd send a couple of armoured cars to see what the form was, but they just drove straight over in close formation. And of course, Gravener was re-shot down from above them, and Gravener was killed almost immediately. Within a matter of about 20 minutes, there were, I think we calculated we'd killed about 70 Germans. Obviously, they bailed out of their vehicles and tried to run for cover, but we had a huge amount of fire directed on them. We had machine guns, stands, and rifles, and a few pits. But the thing that did most damage was the 6-pounder anti-tank gun, which had set itself up below the bridge on the west side, and so they were firing up through the wall on the bridge. And of course they couldn't see, because the wall was fairly high, they really couldn't see what they were shooting at. They could maybe just see the top of a turret, and so they made a whole lot of holes in the wall and shot through that. Certainly after about 20 minutes all the vehicles were on fire or had run off the road. And, of course, it created a pretty solid roadblock, which they weren't able to shift until Wednesday midday, when they brought up some Panzers and Tiger tanks, which were large enough to clear the roadblock. And from that moment onwards, they were able to cruise up and down the road in front of us, firing into our buildings and setting them alight. They came over in close formation and they were all caught. Well, there was no wheeled vehicle or tracked vehicle that came up after that. They were attacking, the infantry was attacking from both sides, but the attack over the bridge lasted, to my recollection, about half an hour.
So with the Germans bringing up their Tigers and Panzer tanks, the roadblock being cleared, running out of ammunition and supplies, running out of men, the inevitable happens. Rather than being killed, Hibbert and his men have no choice but to surrender.
The depressing end of all of that was that I and a very great friend of mine, who was Tony Cottrell, who was the war correspondent attached to us, we eventually, as it got light, we found nowhere else. This was after my little episode where I nearly shot my battery commander. We found an old coal bunker, wooden bunker with a little hole like that where you put your coal in and shoved it out. So we managed to pull all the coal towards the front, and we both managed to get in here and pull the coal back on us. And we waited, and but about midday, we could hear the Germans going round and shooting at anything that might hold anyone hiding. And eventually they came to ours and they fired a few shots into it, luckily not hitting us. And then someone, some corporal, said, have a look, closer look in. And so they looked in and started pulling the thing back, and there we were. And I must confess that in the whole of my military career, it was the lowest moment, you know, your pride, all your pride just disappears. You think, bugger this. This is not what I joined the army for. However, we got out, and we were both covered absolutely black, like blacking up for the minstrel show. And so we cleaned ourselves off, and then I think we managed to laugh a little and got our spirits up. But just sort of carrying on from that, we were then marched up to a small house on the outskirts of Arnhem. And I must say here that Freddie Gough, who was later, he was assassinated, wasn't he, as an MP by the IRA. He was a very good chap, and he said, well, now, gentlemen, there were about 30 of us, officers and other ranks, they'd put us in a cathedral which was still burning with the walls falling on us. So they hauled us out and told us to march up to the outskirts of Arnhem.
And away he went into German captivity. But Tony Hibbert is no normal man. He wasn't going to accept being taken away to Germany. No way. He was being transported by lorry to Germany. He escaped by jumping off the back of the lorry, and there was a Major Dennis Munford that was with him. But don't forget, they'd been captured by the SS, and the guard on the truck opened fire on them both. Munford was wounded and later recaptured. Hibbert was bruised and bloodied from the jump, but he wasn't hit by the bullets and he managed to escape. What he then found out was the SS guard, furious at what had happened, lost his head. He fired his machine gun into the back of the truck. There were several of Tony's unarmed comrades in there, and six of them were killed. And later on in life, Hibbert said about this, "This is a burden I shall carry to my grave." He blamed himself for the death of those men. He then linked up with the Dutch resistance, and he and other British officers were able to round up remnants of the 1st Airborne Division that evaded capture from the Germans. And they managed to get across the Rhine, 138 of them, back into Allied positions. Hibbert was then sitting on the bonnet of an overcrowded jeep, and it collided in the dark with another jeep coming in the opposite direction. He broke his leg very badly, and it meant that he had to come back to the UK and was 5 months in hospital. In 1945, he was awarded the Military Cross for his gallant actions at the bridge and during the escape. And in 2009, he donated this Military Cross medal to the Hartenstein Museum in Oosterbeek. And he said he'd done that in recognition of the acts of heroism that had been performed by the Dutch people, the civilians, in sheltering and aiding the remnants of the British Airborne Division. In 2011, he was presented the Colonel Commandant of the Parachute Regiment with a ceremonial sword, and that sword was known as the Hibbert Sword. And he asked for it to be awarded annually to the most promising young officer. And he also co-founded the Arnhem 1944 Fellowship, which is still going to this day. And his story ended 10 years ago on the Sunday, the 12th of October 2014, surrounded by his family at the age of 97. He finally died. His long life, his great life ended. So what became of John Frost himself, Major General John Frost? Well, he was captured having been wounded, as he said, in the shin, on the bridge or near the bridge. He returned to Arnhem many times. He was taken prisoner. He was liberated in March 1945 by the Americans. And he died in May 1993, aged 80 years old. If you go to the bridge now, it's an enormous bridge spanning the Rhine. And there's a sign in the airborne colours. And it says that the bridge is now called the John Frost Bridge. And Frost was there when the bridge was officially renamed in his honour. And he also gave his closing thoughts on what happened there. He said, "We were very proud to have been selected for this task. And to start with, we were in a tremendous state of morale. We felt that we'd captured the real prize of the whole war. And as long as we could hold on to it, then we were going to see the Guards Division, 30 Corps, the whole thing steaming by to finish the war. And then gradually it began to dawn that if it was going to happen at all, it would be much later than we hoped or expected. The biggest blow, I think, was when my intelligence officer said, 'Oh, sir, we're taking prisoners for the 9th SS Panzer Division. And we have below an officer who speaks very good English. I think you ought to come and see him.' I went down and saw this officer and I said to him, 'What are you doing here? I thought you were finished in the Falaise Gap.' He said, 'Well, so did we, but we got an awful lot of our drivers and gunners out and radio operators and officers, and we've been up the road refitting. We hope to get reinforcements, and I hope and expect the whole of our division to be around you before very long.' I think I offered him a whiskey and soda. Anyway, I wandered away rather sadly and knew then that the odds must be very much against us." So the accounts we've looked at so far, the battle for Arnhem Bridge, have come from people like Hibbert and Frost, who were senior officers. But what about the other ranks and the NCOs? Well, I've scoured the newspaper archives and I found one from a man called Charles Weir from Aberdeen. And he was there at the bridge. He was eventually captured and sent to Germany, but he managed to escape and marched into the British lines at Nijmegen. And he was with his great mate and commanding officer, Lieutenant Dennis Simpson, who came from Liverpool. Simpson said, "We made a perfect drop on the outskirts of Arnhem. Within an hour, my section had moved off towards its objective, the bridge over the Lower Rhine in the heart of the town. In the darkness, we passed through Oosterbeek and reached Arnhem without any real opposition. Crouching through the streets, we reached the houses on the northern end of the bridge. Our mission was to occupy the houses which commanded access to the bridge." He says they occupied a school building underneath the approach to the bridge. And the first story of that building was above the bridge level. That first night, they charged the pillbox that was guarding the bridge and set fire to an ammunition dump inside the pillbox, which blew up, and 20 Germans ran out with their hands up. He said, "We then pulled back and began fortifying the schoolhouse. By this time, the Germans were attacking the next houses with tanks. Some of the men driven out of this house crept over to the school under cover of darkness and joined us. Other men got through from another battalion to add to our force. We then mustered altogether about 50 men, with others holding other buildings. The next enemy move was to machine gun the school from the rooftops of adjoining buildings. When this failed, they set several houses on fire, hoping that the wind would carry the flames to the school, and that failed too. About midday on Monday the 18th, a convoy of German half-track vehicles came over the bridge, so we opened up with their Brenns and Sten guns and killed the men riding in them. The lorries caught fire. That night there were blazing houses and blazing lorries, and the enemy started mortaring. Then in the darkness they began stalking towards the school. We spied them in time and dropped hand grenades on them. After 5 minutes they withdrew, leaving behind several guns. On Tuesday, two Mark III tanks appeared with 15 infantrymen and began a furious firing. This went on most of the day. One of our men crept across the road under fire and dropped a bomb from a housetop onto the tank and disabled it. That evening, the Germans again tried to burn us out, but our men got on top of the rooftop when the flames spread to the school and managed to put the fire out. All night long, Tiger tanks roamed round shelling the school until it was riddled like a sieve. The next day was so quiet we thought the Germans had pulled out, but at 10 a.m. two Tigers came alongside the quay and started battering away once more. By this time, we had rigged out a radio and were talking from one house to another. From our second floor, we could see Germans putting demolition charges on the bridge. We organised an attack and rushed out with fixed bayonets through the enemy fire, cleared the enemy away from the bridge and removed the charges. Then the Germans counterattacked and drove our fellows out. We organised another bayonet charge. This time we suffered heavy casualties, but all the charges were removed. By this time, the enemy was closing in on us. They set fire to the school and the buildings began to fall in. We had 21 men wounded and decided to try and get out with them. There were now 45 men altogether in our party. We got as far as the next house when the Germans raked the line of our advance and pinned us down. The wounded now totaled 35, and we decided to leave four of our men with the wounded and it gave the rest a chance to escape. But as they got clear of the houses, the Germans closed in and forced the last six of this gallant band, including Corporal Weir, to surrender. And what does Weir say? He says, "On Wednesday night, their ammunition was exhausted and the whole area blazing around us, the schoolhouse itself in flames. We tried to get out, dodging from street to street, fighting Nazis with our knives and our bare hands. We found ourselves with our backs to the walls, surrounded by Boche. When taken prisoner, we were taken to the Rhine by boat into Germany and imprisoned. On the first night there, we worked in relays on the barred windows of our prison and got away. We walked west the remainder of that night and lay low in hedges and ditches most of the next day. We came in the next morning to Nijmegen and walked into the British lines on Sunday morning." Now, I realise that this podcast has now lasted for well over an hour, and all we really talked about is the initial drops and the battle for Arnhem Bridge. But in front of me, I've got many, many more stories to tell about the Oosterbeek perimeter, about some of the incredible civilian stories, and about some of the ferocious fighting that took place in and around the St. Elizabeth Hospital. So I think what we're going to have to do is record a second episode about the Battle of Arnhem later on this week. So please do remember to subscribe, and then you'll get an automatic update in your podcast wherever you get them from. And it's also useful, please, if you wouldn't mind leaving a review and a rating wherever you get your podcast from, in particular on Spotify and Apple. They seem to be the two most popular ways that people receive this podcast. So there was much bloodshed in and around the Arnhem Bridge. 750 men arrived at the bridge alongside John Frost. Only about 130 of them escaped without being killed, wounded or taken prisoner. And it was eventually established that 81 men were either killed or died of their wounds. And it's in their memory, along with those Dutch civilians that also died in the Battle of the Bridge, that we play The Last Post.